offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I'm joining you live from our studios at the Shri Satya Sai Media Center, and it's my pleasure as always to join you on this satsang, on this journey, on this pilgrimage into the Bhagavad Gita. And together we have completed one third of the beautiful work. Truly speaking, we'll be completing one third only today, because we will be doing a summary of the sixth chapter, and with that we will conclude the sixth chapter. From the kind of responses that I've received, the summary episodes are eagerly looked forward to, because probably of the pace with which we cover the other shlokas, it gives a better idea to listen to the summary to understand the entire flow of the chapter, and I agree with that. But at the same time, it also gives us a lot of pleasure to go through each verse in as much detail as well. So given that a lot of people are keenly looking forward to the summary, I think it puts a little more burden on me to ensure that I don't miss out anything in the process of the summary, so that in case someone is listening only to these summary episodes, they still get a fair idea of whatever we are covering in the other episodes. So given that, it may happen that I might be a little slow today, I might not cover the entire summary today. It has happened even in the past chapters. If that happens, whatever little portion is left, we'll take it up next week before we commence the seventh chapter. So we'll begin with the summary of the sixth chapter. It's been a beautiful chapter. In fact, it's one of those chapters which is known by multiple names. As we have seen, every chapter has a name. The first one was Arjuna Vishada Yoga, and then we had chapter 3, which was Karma Yoga, chapter 2 was Sankhya Yoga, and so on and so forth. So this chapter, sixth chapter, is called by different names. It is called Dhyana Yoga, because a big portion of this chapter deals with meditation. It is also called Atma Samyama Yoga, meaning the yoga of self-control. Again, a reference to an important portion of this chapter where Krishna very beautifully explains how the mind can be brought under control. In some places, it is also referred to as Adhyatma Yoga, because you cannot speak of controlling the mind without trying to understand it, right? So because it explains the nature of the mind, which means one's own nature, right? Here, Adhyatma does not necessarily mean knowledge of the Atma, but knowledge of oneself. And when I say myself, right now, I'm all of this, right? My personality, my true self, and everything together is what I am at this point from my reference. So Adhyatma Yoga is a attempt to understand yourself, and that is why this chapter is also referred to as Adhyatma Yoga. But one thing that has to be kept in mind is that all these themes are dealt with in the backdrop of the basic instruction that Krishna is giving Arjuna, which is how to transform mundane actions into spiritual actions, how to transform karma into karma yoga. That is the basis, right? If we lose sight of this, then it'll appear that though Krishna praised something in the previous chapter, here he's saying something else. This is totally different. A lot of people have this comment about the Bhagavad Gita, that Krishna, when he speaks about jnana, he says the jnani is the greatest. When he speaks about karma, he says the karma yogi is the greatest. When he's speaking about dhyana, he's saying the one who meditates is greatest. Then later when he speaks about bhakti, he's going to say the bhakta is the greatest. That is not the case, because if we lose sight of what is the underlying discourse, then we will see a disconnect between the various chapters. So it is always important to remember that the undercurrent of whatever Krishna has been saying, is going to say, is that how to transform your life into a spiritual life, how to make your karma into karma yoga, right? And maybe to ensure this continuity, Krishna begins with two shlokas in this chapter that reiterates what has been said in the previous chapters. So he says, अनाश्रितः कर्मफलं कार्यं कर्म करोति यः स सन्यासी च योगी च. The one who performs his actions without aspiring for fruits of actions is a karma yogi, he is also a sannyasi. So in the previous chapter, Krishna made it very clear that karma yoga and sannyasa are only different pathways. It is not that one is higher and one is lower, or one is better than the other, or nothing like that. It is only a choice whether you want to go into this pathway or you want to go into that pathway. And each choice always comes with its own set of duties. It has its own set of duties as well as its own set of regulations and disciplines, right? So just like whether I become a doctor or a lawyer is a choice that I have, and based on the choice that I make, there are certain changes in the way I must act, and there are certain changes in my lifestyle that will kick in based on that choice. But the basic integrity that is expected of me, the basic human goodness that is expected of me, that doesn't change with the choice of profession. In the same manner, that basic quality that Krishna has been speaking about is not to have expectations. So if we really want to become spiritual, the choice is not as important as this underlying quality that Krishna is repeating over and over again. That's how Krishna starts this chapter. He says, O Arjuna, by becoming a monk or by sitting in tapas does not make you spiritual. If you are truly interested in spirituality, this is what you must do. And in the next shloka, Krishna goes on to say that what is referred to as sannyasa is also nothing different from karma yoga. Why? Because as Krishna made it very clear in the third chapter, no one is escaping from karma. No one can run away from action or activity. Even if you become a sannyasi, you only have to perform a different set of karma, a different set of activities, right? Some of us have chosen to settle down in the ashram instead of being in the cities where we grew up and where we were born. It only means I will be performing a different set of actions. Swami had once said this to a devotee. He said, I named this place Prashanti Nilayam and I did not name it Sri Satya Sai Ashram because devotees should not think that you can come and live here without any shrama or hard work. Shrama means hard work, so ashrama means a place where you can relax and not do any activity. Swami said, that is why I did not name this Satya Sai Ashram. So when we choose to be in Prashanti Nilayam, we may give up actions that we may have otherwise done if we had lived in our native places. But we don't give up actions altogether. Similarly, a sannyasi also continues to perform karma even though he or she has given up worldly life. So karma yoga becomes a mandatory lifestyle for a spiritual person, whether he wants to be a monk or he wants to be a worldly person, right? And likewise, whether you are a sannyasi or a karma yogi, you have to have the attitude of sacrifice, the attitude of tyaga. And what is this that you have to sacrifice? He says that in the very next shloka. He says, asanyasta sankalpaha. One who has not renounced thoughts or sankalpas, na yogi bhavati kaschana, can never be a yogi. And here when he says sankalpas, he means desires and aspirations. The idea about what are these sankalpas will come a little later also. So this is a very important point that Krishna is making. Whether you're a sannyasi or a worldly person, you have to perform karma. So karma yoga becomes mandatory. Whether you're a karma yogi or a sannyasi, you will always have to have a certain amount of sannyasa or sacrifice or renunciation. And what is it that you have to renounce? You have to renounce these desires and aspirations for something in life. The next shloka, Krishna places the idea of Atma Samyama that we spoke about in the title in context. As I mentioned, Atma Samyama or self-control is one of the main themes of this chapter, and meditation is one of the techniques that Krishna speaks in the context of Atma Samyama or self-control. So Krishna explains by using two words, or you could say two kinds of people. One is Arurukshoho Munehe Yogam, that aspirant who wishes to ascend yoga. For an aspirant who wishes to become a yogi, he uses this term, and he says, for such a person, I'm sorry, that is the one of the phrases. I said Krishna uses two phrases, Arurukshoho Munehe Yogam, that aspirant who wishes to ascend to yoga, and Yoga Rudha, one who has already reached that state. So one who is on the path and one who has reached the destination. And Krishna says, for an aspirant who wishes to become a yogi, karma is the means for the path. For an Arurukshoho Munehe Yogam, karma is the means. And for one who has reached the peak, Yoga Rudha, to sustain that state, Shama or equipoise is the means. You can look at this as a journey and a destination, or you can say that Yoga Rudha is also a state. I am an aspirant. There are some days when I am able to do karma in this manner that Krishna is speaking as Karma Yoga, being detached, thinking of Swami and offering whatever I do as an offering to Swami, but I am not in that state always, right? That's the problem with all of us. We can do certain activities with that attitude of Karma Yoga, but it doesn't become the very nature of how we perform our actions. So even if we are talking about this idea of Yoga Rudha as a state that we go into and come out, we have these moments when I am able to act with the right kind of awareness. And if I want to sustain that, then that is the challenge that we face. So Krishna introduces the concept of dhyana as a technique by which that state can be sustained. And when you practice this dhyana, that state of shama that Krishna is talking about as a tool by which you maintain the state, right? That's what we are talking of. You can go into and come out of this attitude of performing actions with awareness. But if you want to maintain that, you need equipoise. And to gain that equipoise, you have to use dhyana as a tool. In the very next shloka, Krishna defines Yoga Rudha as one who is able to act completely selflessly. Na Indraya Arteshu, not in sense objects, na karmasu, not in actions, anushajjate, he or she is attached. So who has given up all sankalpas, sarva sankalpa sanyasi, such a person is a Yoga Rudha. As I said, this can be spoken of as a person who has reached that destination, or a state of mind we intermittently reach in the journey to the ultimate destination. So to sustain that, Shama is the means. Krishna then in a very interesting way speaks about the importance of self-mastery or self-control in the next few shlokas, starting from the fifth shloka. Krishna says in that shloka, you are your own friend, you are your own enemy. Atmaiva hi atmano bandhu, atmaiva ripuratmanaha. A very profound statement that we dwelt upon immensely when we were going through this part. In the spiritual path, we alone are responsible for our redemption. We alone are responsible for the failure that we face. Because for a karma yogi, even the worst situation becomes a means for spiritual progress. I face a disaster, I face a failure, or I see enormous success and profits. If I am by nature a karma yogi, if my attitude is that of karma yoga, if I am a sadhaka, if I am a mumukshu and arurukshu, as we have seen, then it all becomes only an opportunity to progress. In that sense, when we turn to spirituality, we lose the freedom to complain because there is nobody to point a finger at. We are responsible for where we are. We are responsible if we slip, right? That's why one of the finest and beautiful reminders Krishna gives in the form of the statement, Atmaivahi Atmano Bandhu, Atmaiva Ripuratmanaha. You are your own friend. You are your own foe. So how does the idea of self-control come into play when Krishna is speaking about this? When Krishna says, you are your own enemy, you are your own friend, there is some change in the nature of some instruments within, right? The same instruments harm, the same instruments serve our interests. As Swami has repeatedly said, and we've heard it many, many times in Swami's voice, he says, manayeva karanam bandha mokshayoho. Manayeva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshayoho. He says, the same mind is responsible for binding you, the same mind is responsible for your freedom, right? So there is a state of mind in which it makes you get more bound. There is a state of mind in which it leads you to freedom, right? So this, when we say Atma Vahi Atmano Bandhu, one of the words Atma is used for is to represent this body, mind, senses complex, apart from Atma, which we use it for referring to the Supreme Self, right? This is something that I've mentioned multiple times during this chapter and the previous one. When you use the word Atma, it is just like the English word self. I use that English word self not only to refer to the Supreme Divine Self, I use the word self even to refer to me. You know, you can call me, when I say myself, or myself, Premanusha, as I introduce myself, right? So that self, the word is used for the Supreme Self as well as this body-mind complex. So when Atmaivahi Atmano Banduhu, there is some change in the state of this body-mind complex. When that happens, I become my own enemy, or there is another change by which I become my own friend. And that Krishna explains in the very next shloka. He says, Banduhu Atma Atmanah Tasya. The self is the friend of the self for him. Yena Atma Eva Atmana Jitaha. For whom the self has been conquered by oneself. Atmanastu Shatrutve Vartata Atma Eva Shatrutvat. When one is not in control of oneself, then he or she becomes or stands as an enemy to oneself. So that state of self-control decides whether one is one's own friend or one is one's own foe. And this self-control is expressed in everyday life as equanimity. How is control related to equanimity and spiritual life? In spirituality, one needs the ability to proceed towards a purpose or a goal that one has set for oneself. And one must have the focus not to be deterred by that obstacle and the temptations that present themselves in this path, right? In the next three verses of this portion, Krishna explains how this person will have an equal vision towards all varieties of people or all varieties of opposites that one comes across. So Krishna says, a jitatma, one who has conquered oneself, will be equal-minded in Shitoshna Sukadukheshu Tatha Manapamana Yoho. Shitoshna Sukadukheshu. In heat and cold, happiness and sorrow, Mana Apamana Yoho. In fame and infamy. In the 8th shloka, Krishna says, Samaloshta Ashma Kanchanaha. Loshta means a clod of clay, Ashma means a stone, and Kanchana means gold. So someone who treats all these different objects as being the same, right? So you can see the first one is about the different states around us. It is hot, it is cold, different states of mind. It is something that is making you happy, something that makes you sorrowful, fame and infamy. At the same time, he also says, Samaloshtashma Kanchanaha. Even objects, you don't distinguish them as one being more valuable than the other. And in the 9th shloka, he gives a list of different types of people that you encounter depending on how we relate to them and seeing equanimity or seeing the sameness in all of them. He says, Suhrit, a benefactor, Mitraha, a friend, Ari, an enemy, Udhasina, an indifferent person or someone who is neutral to both parties, madhyastha, one who is an arbiter or a well-wisher for both, adveshya, the one who is hateful, bandhu, a relative, sadhushu, for the righteous, apicha, and also papeshu, even whether that person is unrighteous. So after giving this entire list of situations, objects, and kinds of people we interact with, Krishna says, the yukta is one who has samadrishti towards all this. But this whole idea is made very practical by a phrase that Krishna makes in the 8th verse. He says, jnana vijnana triptatma. One who is satisfied with jnana and vijnana. Which means, when we speak of equal vision, it means in the pursuit of knowledge and righteousness, all these opposites appear the same. Whether it is gold or a piece of stone, if it belongs to someone else, I will not take it. My righteousness does not permit me to look at a stone as being any way less valuable than a gold, right? A very precious object in front of me does not change my nature of righteousness. And the ultimate expression of this is the ability to see the same self in all kinds of people, right? When it comes to the different kinds of people, whom I am interacting with does not decide what is my nature. If my nature is loving, whether it is a Sukhrit, the Mitra, Ari, Udasina, or whatever that list is, my nature does not change. And this is all possible only the ultimate understanding or the ultimate expression or attitude with which this is possible is when you are able to see the same self in everyone. So this samadrishti, equal vision, is a very important topic, and much of what Krishna says in this chapter is going to revolve around this quality that Krishna speaks of, the ability of seeing sameness in this variety and multiplicity that we are encountering in life. From the 10th shloka is where truly the dhyana yoga part actually starts. Excuse me, I just had a sip of water. Sorry for taking that break. So Krishna starts by saying in the 10th shloka, speaking about this idea of dhyana yoga. But as I just said, the dhyana that Krishna speaks about is to effect the samadrishti that he spoke of, which is a result of atma samyama or self-mastery. So because self-mastery is what will give the samadrishti, right? As he said, in the path of yoga, you are your own enemy, you are your own friend. How do you become your enemy? If you do not conquer yourself, how do you become your friend? If you conquer yourself, and if you conquer yourself, what happens? You get samadrishti, and that samadrishti is the ultimate goal of this path of yoga. So to get to that samadrishti, you have to start with self-mastery, and dhyana is a tool, and that is how dhyana is introduced in this chapter. So Krishna starts by saying that the yogi must try to concentrate on the self regularly, sitting in solitude and secrecy. Rahasi stitaha ekaki. The idea is, one gives this process of meditation the due respect by maintaining this time in solitude, and also a certain amount of secrecy is also attached to the process, where you don't make a scene of it. You don't meditate one day and then immediately go to social media and say, you know what, I meditated today and I had this experience, right? So it is given a due respect by rahasi stataha ekaki, by keeping the place where you do this secretive and the process itself a little secretive, and it is done in solitude. So one can also try and, as I said, avoid discussing about the experiences one has when this is practiced. And we had gone through discourses where Swami speaks of the importance of this particular discipline being followed. And one of the very beautiful analogies that Swami gives is, fish is sold in an open market, but diamonds that are precious are carefully preserved at the jeweler's shop and displayed only to worthy customers. So Swami says meditation must be given due respect by keeping it secretive. Krishna adds two more instructions in that very shloka. He says, Nirashihi aparigraha. When sitting for meditation, sit without having expectations and cravings. Sit with a calm mind. At least that period of meditation, we can just be in the moment without any desires. And this is one of the ways by saying the period of meditation is not a period of putting forth to God your needs and your desires and your ambitions in life, right? When you say nirashihi aparigraha, you cannot sit in this period of meditation with having all these desires clouding your mind. And this is going to be, Krishna repeats this idea in a different way. Again, later we'll come to that very shortly. So at least that period of meditation, can we have this attitude of not having any aspirations and not having any cravings. In the next few shlokas, Krishna goes on to give some very interesting practical tips about how one can practice meditation or dhyana. Now, Swami says, this process of dhyana that Arjuna is being taught here by Krishna is referred to as sukha dhyana, or dhyana that is done in comfort. The idea is not to indulge in comforts. So sukha dhyana does not mean that your meditation is being done in luxury. The idea is not to try yourself out in austerities and penance in that sense. The whole concept is, how often can you catch your mind and make it focus on the self, right? So the whole idea of the sukha dhyana is, try to control what can be controlled around you. If people around you are disturbing you all the time, find a time when people around you are not around you, right? When you are able to sit in solitude, find a time when you are able to, or find a place where you are not going to be disturbed. So that is why it is called sukha dhyana, not because you have to indulge in these sukhas or luxuries, but try to avoid distractions. And that is why this is a dhyana where you take control of what can be controlled around you. So in the 11th and 12th shloka, Krishna speaks about the place where you have to meditate, the seat, the desha and the asana. All of these are discussed in very great detail in the next few shlokas. Krishna says, Shuchau deshe pratishtapya stiram asanam atmanaha. You should have a stable and firm seat in a clean place. The seat should be na atyuchitam, not very high, na ati nicham, not very low. Then Krishna describes the asana, or the seat on which the meditator must sit. And that is done very quite specifically, because he says, Chaila ajina kusha uttaram. The seat should be of kusha grass, on top of it an animal skin, and on top of that a soft white cloth. All these instructions can be spoken of as a simple practical tip that Krishna is giving. And of course, they also have few inner significances. We did discuss about them as well. But much of this is also very practical. The idea of preparing the seat in a certain manner, not to sit too high, not to sit too low, having three layers of seating, sitting in solitude, these are all instructions to ensure that you don't have to be worried about some simple issues like the cold radiating from the floor, insects around you. When you keep the place clean around you, you're not going to be disturbed by mosquitoes and ants and such things. So these are all very simple tips. As I said, take control of what is around you to ensure that you can concentrate the mind, right? Even if you take control of all of this, the mind still remains uncontrollable. So at least take control of what is around you so that the mind can be put through this process of dhyana. So that is the whole idea. Right? But at the same time, when Krishna says you should be in a clean place, it also has a certain inner significance. And we had discussed about this. Swami has spoken about this very beautifully in his discourses. He says the true asana for a person who is meditating is this body, is the heart. The place where the asana is placed is the body. So the place is the body, the seat of meditation is the heart. So when Krishna says you have to purify this, it means the body must be clean, the heart must be clean, right? So you must have a certain amount of purity in the heart to start with. We had discussed how though dhyana is meant to lead one to purity and lead one to self-mastery or self-control, even to begin with, even to start this practice of dhyana, you do need a certain amount of purity, you do need a certain amount of self-discipline, right? Sitting at the same place at the same time, a certain aspect of discipline that we spoke about as maintaining, Krishna is going to speak about the posture and so on and so forth. So all of this is the prerequisite self-control and self-discipline. Through practicing it, you will also gain a certain amount of self-control and self-mastery. Similarly, Krishna is going to speak about how a meditator becomes purified in this process, right? So even though the process of meditation is meant to purify, you need a certain amount of purity going into it as well, right? So Krishna says the meditator should be a yata chitendriya kriyaha, one who has a certain control over the mind, senses and the body. Yata chitta indriya kriyaha, control over mind, senses and the body. Later Krishna also speaks about certain habits which we will come to, the ahara viharas, as Swami would say. So when we speak of purity, the prerequisite purity for one who takes to this path of meditation, as we had discussed, simple things like leading a moral life becomes that prerequisite purity. And the purity that is eventually achieved through the process of dhyana is the removal of raga and dvesha, which is the ultimate cleansing that happens in the mind. So one needs purity, and also one must aspire for purity through this process. Yunjat yogam atma vishuddhaye. Let him practice dhyana yoga for the purification of the self. So he says atma vishuddhaye. That should be the goal or the aspiration with which one must practice this meditation. Then Krishna describes the posture. He says samam kaya shiro grivam dharayanna achalam stiraha. Holding the body, head and neck erect and still and being steady. Then the aspirant is told to look at the tip of his own nose and not to look around. Again, actually it's a very pretty practical tip. As Swami has explained, when you try to gaze at your nose, you cannot do that without your eyes being half open. So when your eyes are half open, Swami says that, you know, you've created such a cozy place for you to sit down. It's not very hot. It's not very cold. The seat is very comfortable. The chances are that you might doze away, right? So Swami says that you're expected to keep your eyes half open, not to close it completely so that you don't drift away into a dream state, right? So again, very, very practical tips. And when you look at the tip of your nose, you ensure that your eyes are not looking around and are getting distracted. We of course went through some more tips that Swami himself had given in the context of dhyana. We went through all of that. I'm not repeating all of that here. Going back to what Krishna has been saying, having described all this of how to sit, where to sit, what must be the kind of place where you choose to meditate and all of that, in the next few shlokas, Krishna describes the inner discipline that is required. Krishna says, one must be peaceful, fearless, and follow the vow of brahmacharya. Prashantatma vigatabhi brahmachari vratesthitaha. We discussed the importance of each one of these instructions. How when Krishna says fearless, it is again a point, just like aparigraha and nirashihi, what he mentioned. When we say fearless, it could be an indication of how meditation should not be done like a prayer, but a sadhana, right? Because when you pray out of fear, or when you turn to God out of fear, there are expectations, you're looking for something, you're looking for Him to answer. The process of meditation should not be an expression of fear. Again, we've spoken about this in detail. Swami says that there are three types of meditation: sattvic meditation, rajasic meditation, and tamasic meditation. Where Swami said tamasic meditation is when you have a need, you're desperate, and then you start trying to pray to God. You should have the sattvic meditation as your process, where you do it for Atma Vishuddha, for the purification of the self and not for any sort of craving, right? So similarly, when Krishna speaks about Brahmacharya, where he says, Brahmachari Vratesthitaha, the idea of Brahmachari, as we discussed it, is in that phase of life, when one is a Brahmachari, one does not carry the burden of responsibilities of running a family, right? That is the whole idea of having that student phase as a Brahmachari phase. When we were all students, Swami would often say that, don't get burdened with what is happening in your family. That's something that Swami would say, and I honestly did not understand why Swami would say that at that point in time. But Swami would say that to a certain extent, be detached from what is happening in your house. Don't be worried about, how's my father's business doing? How's my cousin and the so-and-so is like this? Swami would say that don't be worried about all of that, because this phase of being a student is referred to as a Brahmachari because as much of time as possible, you give your mind to God. So when Krishna says, when you're practicing meditation, Brahmachari Vratesthitaha, it could very well mean that, can you have the attitude of a Brahmachari when you are taking to this meditation that few minutes a day, right? So that is one of the one of the instructions that Krishna gives. Can you simulate the state of Brahmacharya? Having done all this, what must one meditate upon? Right, that's the question. I have taken care of the external discipline. I have taken care of the physical discipline of how I sit. I have taken care of the internal discipline to a certain extent, let us say. Having done all this, what must I meditate upon? One must meditate on Krishna or the Supreme Lord, and with reaching him as the goal. Matchitto yukta asit matparaha. Matchitto yukta asit matparaha. There are a lot of techniques where people meditate upon objects, people meditate on mantras and syllables, or parts of one's own body, meditate on the thumb, meditate on the nose, as I said. But I think Krishna is making it very clear that meditating on God or meditating on Brahman is the best process. He says, meditate upon me. And this can also be interpreted as meditate upon one's own divine self, right? When I sit and contemplate on God as the Supreme, be it Krishna, Rama or Swami or whatever form of divinity that you'd like to worship, I am contemplating on the divine nature of that form, isn't it? And that nature is also our true nature. So we can say that meditating on God or on the divine principle that permeates this whole creation is certainly advisable. And I'm not going to go into that, but Swami has spoken extensively about Jyoti meditation whenever he speaks about meditation. And the whole idea is, Swami would say, that you're meditating on that quality of omnipresence, right? Omnipresence and omniscience and omnipotence. And that is why Jyoti is used as a symbol. Jyoti is a symbol of bringing one from darkness to light. At the same time, it is something that does not diminish. It is something that can be universal. So all of these qualities is what you're trying to meditate upon, even when you pick a form to meditate on. The 15th verse is more or less like a summary or an explanation of what happens when one meditates in this manner that Krishna says, Matchitto yukta asit matparaha. Meditate on me and meditate to reach me, is what that statement says. So in the 15th verse, he says, one who is able to meditate like this, after controlling the mind, he says, attains the peace by abiding in Krishna and eventually attains nirvana. Verses 16 and 17, Krishna speaks about some of the lifestyle disciplines, right? Till now we spoke about that period of meditation, more or less, right? How do you sit? What kind of seat you have? What kind of thoughts that you have? That again, Krishna is going to speak about a little more. That again is one of the interesting parts of this chapter. But more or less what he has described now is the physical things that you have to do when you are meditating. In the 16th and 17th verse, Krishna speaks about the lifestyle that has to be adopted for a person who is taking to meditation. Krishna says, Atyashnataha, for one who eats too much, anashnataha, one who doesn't eat enough, this dhyana yoga will not help. Moderation in eating. This is not a kind of austerity that you do. It is not like you start meditation and you say, I won't eat for so many days. I want to be a yogi who does not eat at all. That's not the idea, right? That idea of sukha dhyana also means the idea of moderation, the idea of not indulging yourself, but at the same time, not having things around you that will distract you, right? In the same manner, even in lifestyle, that moderation has to be followed. You should not be an atyashnataha, you should not be an anashnataha. Similarly, he says, ati swapnashilasya jagrato, of one who sleeps too much and one who is awake all the time. Even for them, this yoga is not available or is not going to bring the right kind of benefit. So the idea is that a sadhaka must lead a life of balance. As Gautama Buddha said, it's a life of the middle path. We often get carried away, with things that we happen to read in books, or we listen about the great yogis. Oh, this yogi never slept for so many decades. This yogi who does not eat food at all. And we think that sadhana means we have to adopt some kind of extremities like this, right? And that is when I truly become spiritual. But what Krishna says here and what Swami maintains is completely the contrary. To become spiritual is to lead a balanced life. And if you want to be a spiritual person, you must take to this middle path that Krishna is describing here. Then apart from sleeping and eating, Krishna also adds, yukta cheshtasya karmasu. There must be moderation even in efforts and duties. This is a very, very interesting instruction that we discussed about. No single pursuit or no single role that you play in life must define you completely, right? You might be a mother, you might be a father, you might be a husband or a wife. But that is only one of the roles that you play. When Krishna says that you should have attaining God as the ultimate goal, that is what defines you. When you say, I am a yogi, I am a spiritual aspirant, the goal must define your life. And none of these singular roles that you play, which changes within this lifetime and certainly changes after the end of this lifetime, that should not define you. And that is the idea which Krishna probably conveys in this yukta cheshtasya karmasu. Have moderation in the way you perform your duties too. Don't, when you define yourself based on one of the roles that you play, that is when you tend to overdo it. Yes, isn't it? So yes, our actions are defined by the duties and the needs around us. But when the purpose of life is always kept in mind, there will be moderation even in these kind of pursuits and the duties that we follow. From the 18th verse, Krishna shifts the focus from dhyana to the person who has achieved the goal of dhyana. So Krishna mentions in this shloka, the 18th one, what happens to such a meditator or a dhyana yogi? If it has to be expressed simply, the distinction between the state of mind while a person is meditating and the state of mind while one is not sitting in meditation, that distinction vanishes. That is the ultimate goal that you're trying to reach. Today when I practice meditation, I am trying to control all of this, I'm trying to have my mind focused, and I reach a certain state of tranquility of the mind. The goal of this one who practices dhyana yoga is to have that tranquility of mind, to have that focus in the mind at all times when one is awake, right? So that is probably the goal of this dhyana yoga that Krishna is speaking. So Krishna says the ultimate goal of meditation is the state where one's focus is never removed from the Atma and no desires distract and remove this focus. We try to simulate this state in those few minutes that we sit in meditation, and to augment that exercise, Krishna gives a lifestyle of balance that we just spoke about. But this focus of few minutes helps us also lead a life of balance, right? It feeds on each other. The life of balance helps you meditate. When you're good at meditating, it also leads you to lead a life of balance. So eventually, one becomes a yukta for whom the concept of meditation vanishes. So if I'm always focused on the dhyaya, there is no distinction between whether I'm sitting in dhyana or I'm not sitting in dhyana. The focus on dhyaya, atmani eva avatishtate, the mind is always on the dhyaya, on the atma. Doesn't meditation as a concept vanish? So practicing meditation in this manner, the mind of the yogi becomes like the flame in a windless room, right? That is the beautiful analogy that Krishna gives. That is the state this meditator reaches. The meditator's mind reaches the state of a flame that is kept in a windless room. Through this process, what eventually happens? Krishna says, first the meditator sees oneself. Atmana atmanam pashyanna. This means when the mind sees the atma, you're trying to focus the mind on the atma. And through this process, the mind recognizes the self to be the self that it is meditating on. That's what it means. Atmana atmanam pashyanna. In the atma, the mind sees the true self. And then atmani tushyati, and is satisfied in the atma itself. So these are descriptions of the ultimate state that is reached by the yogi. Because once this vision is had, there is no swerving from the truth. Sthitaha, one stays established. Na chalati tatvataha. One does not swerve or move away from this reality. And one experiences sukham atyantikam, infinite bliss. So very beautifully in that few shlokas, Krishna explains what happens to one who meditates. I'm constantly focusing my mind on the atma, and eventually the mind recognizes this pure self as the only self, right? And what is the nature of that atma? It is Satchit Ananda. And when I recognize my nature as Satchit Ananda, there is no question of me craving for anything, wanting something. And that is why the Atmani Tushtati state is reached. I am satisfied in myself. And when I am satisfied in myself, there is nothing that can make me unhappy. And I become Sukham Atyantikam. A person who experiences Sukham Atyantikam, infinite bliss. So having explained the highest state in terms of happiness in those few shlokas, now Krishna explains the same in terms of dukkha or sorrow in the next two verses, that is verses 22 and 23. Krishna says, Yam labdhva cha aparam labham manyate na adhikam tataha. Having reached that state, you feel there is nothing more to achieve. And this peace that is born out of the wisdom that there is nothing more to achieve, Krishna says, even the greatest of sorrows cannot shake. Na dukhena gurunapi vichalyate. From smallest desire, which in our present state, even the smallest desire unsettles our mind, from a smallest desire to the greatest of sorrows, dukhena gurunapi, none of these can unsettle this peace that one has reached. And that is why I said he's describing the same state in context with using the reference of dukkha. The next shloka, Krishna gives a very beautiful definition for yoga using dukkha. He says, dukkha samyoga viyogam yoga. The severance of association with sorrow is yoga. When we talk of yoga, it means to be attached to the Atman, to be attached to God is yoga. But Krishna says it is not only being attached to God, dukkha samyoga viyogam. Right now we are attached to dukkha, right? We are not able to give up dukkha. However much we want to be happy, we are not able to detach ourselves from dukkha. So that dukkha samyogam is what Krishna is referring to. Dukkha samyogam viyogam. To release oneself from the state of being attached to dukkha is a definition that Krishna is giving for yoga. So the state of progress can be defined based on how immune one is to sorrow. So yoga is not merely being established in the atma. can also be described as being detached from sorrow. Okay. And the yoga that Krishna is speaking about here, he concludes that shloka by saying that this yoga must be practiced with steadfastness, and he adds a very beautiful statement. He says, anirvinna chetasa. It should be practiced with a cheerful disposition. Just as we saw that for practicing yoga, you need a certain amount of purity, even though purity is the goal. You need a certain amount of discipline, even though complete self-control is the goal. Similarly, though sukham atyantikam is the goal of this process of meditation, a certain amount of cheerfulness is also required for beginning this practice. So that more or less completes that portion on Dhyana Yoga. In the next few shlokas, Krishna begins to speak about the nature of the mind and how it must be dealt with. This and later when Arjuna asks the question, which they all pertain to understanding the mind and the vagaries of the mind better. And this is one of the reasons why this chapter, as I said, is referred to as Adhyatma Yoga, because it speaks about how to understand one's own nature. The theme, by the way, is still meditation, right? That has not still gone out of picture. The theme is still meditation. So one can look at these shlokas also as an instruction as to what one must do with the mind when one is trying to meditate. The few points that we drew from this section are, sankalpas or thoughts eventually become desires. So the sankalpas themselves have to be given up, which means when thoughts arise, just let them pass instead of dwelling on them constantly. We just started with this chapter by saying that Krishna said whether you're a karma yogi or a sannyasi, you have to renounce sankalpas, you have to renounce desires. So that is an overall instruction as well. But it can also be seen as a specific instruction to somebody who is trying to meditate, right? So this is an explanation of the nature of the mind and how thoughts become desires. But this is also a technique, because Krishna says, mentally refrain the senses. Physically, it has already been done in the process of meditation. When you're closing your eyes, you're sitting quietly and sitting alone. Physically, you have refrained the senses. You can mentally now refrain the senses. But he says there will always be sankalpas. When you have closed your eyes, you closed your doors and there's no sound around, but still there will be thoughts. There will still be waves that arise in the mind, as they say. Those are what we refer to as sankalpas. And these sankalpas, Krishna says, have to be dealt with mentally now. And this, he says, luckily he acknowledges that, does not happen instantly, it does not happen easily. That's why he says, shanaihi shanaihi, gradually or slowly, uparamet, it can be quietened. Then eventually the mind is taught to dwell on the self and the self alone and nothing else. We discuss what it is to dwell on the Atma, because as by nature, as definition, Atma is something that cannot be comprehended. The mind cannot think about the Atma. The mind cannot think about Brahman. Then what do we mean by saying that the mind should be placed on Atma or mind should be placed on Brahman? One of the things that we understood is to contemplate how the self is the source of all, which means when you're able to look beyond the different names and forms, when you're able to look beyond the physicality, what you see is the Atman. To contemplate on that truth, that the Atman is the soul of every soul and the source of everything. This can be contemplated upon. That was one of the ways. The second way is to contemplate on what is Nitya and Anitya, Smara Nitya Anityatam, as Swami would say. What is eternal? What is ephemeral? To constantly look at all these sankalpas that arise and say that what you discard them by contemplating on what is Nitya and what is Anitya. And finally, placing the mind on Atman or Brahman can simply also mean contemplate on God, right? Atma samstam manah kritva. That's what Krishna said, making the mind stand on the Atma. This can also mean think of God, think of Swami, think of Krishna, right? So these shlokas are such that they mention the nature of the mind and also how one must meditate given that this is the nature of the mind. The idea is, first we must acknowledge that this is how the mind is. For instance, in the 26th shloka, Krishna uses three adjectives to describe the mind. He says, it is always going outward, it is restless, it is unstable, it is nischarati, chanchalam, astiram. Three adjectives he uses. But it is mentioned as an instruction. When Krishna says this mind that is unstable and restless, bring it back every time it goes outward. Yato yato nischarate tataha tataha niyamya is what Krishna says. So he describes the nature of the mind but puts it in the form of a command or an instruction. He says this is the nature of the mind. Every small sound, the mind will run after it. Every small smell and sight and whatever it is, the mind will run after it. So it has to be brought back every time it runs away. So this can also be an instruction that is being given to a person who is trying to meditate. Because that is the experience. You try to sit down and meditate. What happens? Every small distraction, the mind is already running in that direction. So acknowledge that that is the nature of the mind. Don't be too perturbed. Every time it happens, just bring the mind back. Yato yato nischarati tataha tataha niyamya. Control it every time it runs away in this manner. And so Krishna says that when this is done, when you say that the mind is always running away, you are talking about the rajasic quality of the mind. So when this is done over a period of time, he says, the quality of rajas is removed from the mind and that is how it eventually becomes pure. Verses 29 and 30 are very beautiful verses that describe the very goal of all spiritual endeavor. Whatever be the path, this is the ultimate, as Krishna is saying. And what is beautiful is, Krishna says the same thing from the point of view of a jnani and from the point of view of a bhakta. Of course, that dichotomy of jnani and a bhakta and a jnana and bhakti marga is only in our mind. There is no contradiction from the way Krishna is saying it here. Because Krishna says, yoga yuktatma, one who is ever established in the atma through the process of yoga, sarva bhutastham atmanam sarva bhutani cha atmani ikshate. Sarva bhutastham atmanam sees everyone, sees that everyone in reality is the same self. Sarva bhutani cha atmani. And he understands that the self contains all that he sees. So that is what he says, that when you ultimately reach the goal, you will find that the same self that dwells in you dwells in everyone. And whatever you see, animate and inanimate, is contained in this self. And in the very next shloka, Krishna says, Yo mam pashyati sarvatra, sarvam cha mahi pashyati. He who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, suggesting that for a devotee, through the ultimate stage, for the devotee, the ultimate stage is to be able to see the Lord in everyone and everything as contained in the Lord. The same description that Krishna gave in the previous shloka, now explained in terms of a devotee and his relationship to the Lord. And as we discussed, this is the stage of ananya bhakti that Swami speaks about. And this is the culmination for the path of bhakti. You start with samanya bhakti and eventually you must reach this ananya bhakti where you don't see anything but the Lord in whatever you see. And for us devotees who want a means to always be near Swami, we are trying to invoke Swami's presence, invoke Swami's nearness and dearness in our life. This is a very beautiful shloka, because when he says, Yo mam pashyati sarvatra sarvam cha mahi pashyati, he who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, Krishna says, Tasyaham na pranashyami sacha me na pranashyati. He never becomes separated from me, nor do I become separated from him. Whatever be the state of that devotee, he or she will always remain in me, says Krishna. So this is another way of saying that this peace that no sorrow can trouble can be reached, right? What Krishna spoke of in the description below. So Krishna ends this portion with a shloka that suggests that this idea of oneness is the very basis of dharma. To be able to see others' needs, happiness and sorrow as one judges one's own needs, happiness and sorrow is the state of the yogi. And truly speaking, this is quite superfluous when you're talking about the jnani, because the jnani already sees only oneness and there is no he and myself in the case of a jnani. So this is a statement that Krishna makes as a hint to the sadhaka, that you should be able to treat everybody's needs and happiness and sorrow as you would treat your own. Right? So this is the part where Krishna speaks about the ultimate goal. The next part of this chapter is based on a very important question that Arjuna raises. And unfortunately, we don't have time for that. I thought I'm going to be able to finish this entire summary in this 1 hour, but in spite of trying to speak as fast as I can, I don't think I'm able to do that. So, dear listeners, we will have to stop it here and I will complete the summary of this very important portion. Because in many ways, as many commentators say, the Bhagavad Gita could have stopped at this point where Krishna says that the devotee sees me in everyone and this is the state one has to reach. But because Arjuna asks a very important question, a question that bothers most of us, Krishna does not stop here and goes on to explain. So that part we will take up next week. I will start with that and then the remaining time we'll take the first few verses of the 7th chapter. So thank you, dear listeners, for being with me. I hope that summary was useful. I know it was a little more exhaustive than I initially intended, but I think it was useful to give a complete context of this entire chapter. I hope you'll agree with me. So do join me again next week. We'll complete the summary when we meet next time, next Thursday, 7:30 p.m. So I most humbly offer this at Swami's Lotus Feet. Till I meet you all next time, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.